concerned with those issues. And during the primary, there was a lot of talk on your show. Juan Gonzalez asked her a question during his Daily News interview with her. But largely, she skated. Nobody, that debate was held on the margins. That the campaign is now front and centering Honduras is quite an audacious act, I think, right? And transforming Honduras from a real place in which a sharp people like Berta Cáceres, with a sharp political analysis of U.S. policy, gets transformed into a kind of an imaginary kingdom of bromides, of feel-good uplift, hence the title Eat, Pray, Starve. The second consequence is that Tim Kaine supports free trade, and he has supported the militarization of Honduras. So, yes, quickly, while he is decent on immigration and humane on immigration, even signing a letter recently calling for a halt of the horrible
5 seconds.
Deportations. He structurally supports the policies, free trade and militarization, that produce the poverty, the violence, and the immigration in Central America. So that's the split in the neoliberal mind that Tim Kaine represents.
Greg Grand, I want to thank you for being with us, professor of Latin American history at New York University. And that does it for our 2 weeks of Breaking with Convention. Special thanks to our fellow Pedro Rodriguez on his final day with us. All the best to you, Pedro. I'll be doing a report back from the conventions tonight, Friday, July 29th at Provincetown Town Hall in Massachusetts, and Saturday, July 30th at Martha's Vineyard, Old Wailing Church. Check to Mux now. Special thanks to the team here at Philly Cam, Laura Deutsch, Gretchen Klausing, Ryan Saunders, and to Mike Burke and Nermin Shea, Carla Wills, Laura Gattesdino, Dina Guzda, Sam Alkoff, Jarena Nadura, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Elizabeth Fresh, John Hamilton, Dennis Moyne, and I'm Amy Goodman.
KBOO Portland. The time is now 5 p.m. and coming up next is your KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned.
Join Grassroots News Friday, July 29th from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m. as we honor the free spirit and musical genius of Minnie Riperton. From her doo-wop period at Chess Records to her funky psychedelic soul at Rotary Connection to her solo period, Loving You. Miss Minnie Riperton on Friday, July 29th from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m. on KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Extreme Amateur Games Skate Competition Round 2, Sunday, July 31st at D Block Indoor Skate Park in Clackamas. This is Round 2 in the Mad Bro Extreme Amateur Games. Winners are allowed to compete in following competitions and in the final. Again, that's Extreme Amateur Games Skate Competition Round 2, Sunday, July 31st at D Block Indoor Skate Park, 8921 Southeast Jansen Road in Clackamas. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Hillary Clinton accepts the Democratic nomination for president.
Mayor Hills pushes the date back for sweeps along the spring water corridor.
And hearings for the Vancouver oil terminal come to a close.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, July 29th, 2016. I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
And I'm Liam Delta. Hillary Clinton accepted the Democratic Party's nomination in Philadelphia last night, becoming the first woman in U.S. history to head a major party's presidential ticket. FSRN's Nell Abram has more.
Hillary Clinton accepted the Democratic Party's nomination in Philadelphia Thursday evening, becoming the first woman in U.S. history to head a major party's presidential ticket.
And so, my friends, it is with humility determination, and boundless confidence in America's promise that I accept your nomination for President of the United States.
The Democratic Party went to great lengths to project an image of patriotism and inclusiveness at its nomination convention. Also making history, Sarah McBride, a spokesperson for the pro-LGBTQ rights group, the Human Rights Campaign, became the first openly transgender speaker to address a major party's convention.
LGBTQ people are still targeted by hate that lives in both laws and in hearts. Many still struggle just to get by. But I believe that tomorrow can be different. Tomorrow we can be respected and protected, especially if Hillary Clinton is our president. And that's why I'm proud to stand here and say that I'm with her. Thank you all very much.
That set the tone for the evening, which also included a Pakistani-American whose 28-year-old son enlisted in the U.S. Army and was killed in Iraq in 2004. Khizr Khan challenged Republican nominee Donald Trump directly, saying Trump's anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim rhetoric would bar people like his late son from the United States.
He vows to build walls and ban us from this country.
In her acceptance speech, Clinton also expressed appreciation for Senator Bernie Sanders, whose campaign energized tens of thousands of new voters in the primary and whose support she'll need in the general election.
Bernie, your campaign inspired millions of Americans, particularly the young people who threw their hearts and souls into our primary. You put economic and social justice issues front and center where they belong. And to all of your supporters here and around the country, I want you to know, I've heard you. Your cause is our cause.
But whether the Democratic Party has been truly united remains an open question. That was the impression of Think Progress political reporter Alice Olstein, who covered both conventions from the floor.
For the Republican Party, their so-called big tent is really shrinking. They are backing policies and rallying behind candidates who are alienating a lot of people who used to feel that the Republican Party could include them. Muslims, for instance, used to support the Republican Party in fairly large numbers and now have been completely turned off by Donald Trump's rhetoric and promises.
But Olstein cautions that doesn't mean all is rosy for the Democrats. There remains a wide gulf between expectations among the liberal wing of the party energized by Bernie Sanders and the Democratic leadership, which is tacking to the right to court disaffected Republicans.
We see a party that is trying to have such a big tent and include so many different groups that it's stretching to the breaking point. And they are trying to be everything to everyone. And that's causing some tension and some anger. And people are saying, look, you can't be the party of Elizabeth Warren railing against the big banks and be the party of Michael Bloomberg. And yet we saw both of those people on the stage this week.
The question remains whether Hillary Clinton can truly bring progressive Democrats and left-leaning independent voters with her. That's something she's so far had a hard time reconciling and will be a major challenge if she wants to ensure a healthy turnout in November.
I think that we are going to see this tension and anger going forward. And I think certain groups, including some of the former Bernie Sanders supporters, are wondering if the party is for them and if the party is a place where they, you know, feel that they can identify.
Now that the conventions are over, the nation's attention can turn to the matchup between Clinton and running mate Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia on one side and Trump and Indiana Governor Mike Pence on the other. But the first one-on-one televised debate isn't scheduled until September 26th.
This morning, the month-long hearing on the Vancouver oil terminal came to a close. The proposed Tesoro Savage oil terminal would be the largest oil-by-rail terminal in the Northwest and would bring thousands of oil trains through the Columbia River Gorge. KBOO's Ray Bodwell spoke with Michael Lang of Friends of the Columbia Gorge.
Michael, my understanding is that the month-long Tesoro Vancouver oil terminal hearings are ending today. Can you give us an update, a status report on what's going on and what the path forward is?
Well, today is the last day, the culmination of a five-week-long hearing before the Washington FSEC, Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council, on whether to approve or deny what would be the largest oil terminal in North America, located on the banks of the Columbia River. This terminal would transport 360,000 barrels or 15 million gallons of oil by rail through the Columbia River Gorge, a national scenic area, all through communities around, along the rail lines to a major terminal, and then transferred to ships where it would be shipped down the river to refineries in California. This terminal would not even serve the state of Washington or our region at all. And towns throughout the gorge and all along the rail lines are opposed to it. Many of their representatives are here today. The tribes throughout the region oppose it. They have their attorneys and representatives here today, too. The city of Vancouver and the city of Portland oppose this terminal. Many state agencies oppose it. And this morning, the Washington State Attorney General announced that he is opposed and is recommending denial, recommending that the council deny this project because of the incredible risk to the environment, risk to public safety, and little or no benefit to the state of Washington. So that's very powerful. I don't think that's ever happened before in the history of Washington FSEC.
What can you tell us, Michael, about the company that's pushing for the Vancouver terminal?
Vancouver Energy, the company that is behind this project, is really a shell company that's run by Tesoro Oil Company, created, you know, basically an LLC in Delaware where they have no insurance, they have no employees, they won't divulge their financial records to the Washington FSEC at all. They are just created to protect the parent oil company from any liability from an oil spill. And the oil spill costs are estimated to reach $5 to $6 billion if there was an oil spill in the Columbia River. Well, guess what? Vancouver Energy is not insured to cover the losses at all. It would devastate salmon runs and habitat and really reverse billions of dollars of investment in the Columbia River to maintain and restore salmon runs. Now, incredibly, Tesoro or Vancouver Energy, their shell corporation, says that a spill would be good for the economy. It would create jobs. This is on the record from their experts. They also have testified that an oil spill in the Columbia would be good for salmon runs, incredibly justifying that effort to clean up oil would actually benefit salmon habitat. These are just a few examples of how Vancouver Energy has demonstrated to us and to the council how they can't be trusted with an oil terminal on the Columbia River. They can't be trusted with transporting oil through the Columbia River Gorge, and this project should be denied.
Now, at the close of the public comment period, is that the end of the actual process itself, and then it becomes time for a decision?
Sure. A little bit about the process. After the close of public testimony today, the formal record will be closed, and then there will be final briefing that will run through August with the deadline for final briefs on August 31st. And then after that, there'll be an issuance of a final environmental impact statement and a recommendation from the Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council to the governor on whether the governor of Washington should approve or deny the project. Ultimately, the decision is made by the Washington governor, and that decision probably won't be made until the winter of 2017.
For KBOO Community News, this is Ray Bodwell.
Portland Mayor Charlie Hales has agreed to delay a planned sweep of the houseless community along the Springwater Corridor Trail after a lawsuit was threatened. There are still plans to go ahead with a sweep on September 1st, despite opposition from a variety of community groups. Social service providers have argued that there are simply not enough services to fill the overwhelming demand. Housing waitlists are years long, and a stay at a shelter can take months of waiting. One estimate is that there are about 500 people living along the corridor.
On Thursday, the Metro Council held a hearing on divestment of fossil fuels in the Portland region. The resolution to divest passed 6-1. The resolution stated that, quote, holding the securities of fossil fuel companies is inconsistent with Metro's sustainability goals. The city of Portland and Multnomah County have already passed similar resolutions. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke with Sandy Polishuk of 350pdx.org to find out more about the divestment movement.
Sandy, so this movement to get Metro to pass a resolution that they will not ever invest in fossil fuels, this is a new movement, the divestiture movement from fossil fuels. Can you talk about that? If there are larger goals there or what?
That movement started, Bill McKibben was the spokesperson. He came through Portland on what he called the Do the Math Tour and launched this divest campaign. And since then, over $3 trillion of investments have been pledged to divestment. It's not talking about a particular country. It's not talking about any politics. It's talking about our planet. And we share that planet. It really doesn't matter when that coal is brought out of the ground, if it's burned here or in China. It all goes into our atmosphere, our closed atmosphere.
How is this movement rolling out, in your opinion? I feel like this is one of the most compelling global movements I ever thought of, and I would have never anticipated that it would exist here in the modern age. I'm remembering the anti-nuclear movement, but this one feels different. Can you talk a little bit about the grassroots organizing of it?
Well, what feels different to me is how quickly our credibility has been established. We're working with Metro. We're working with the city of Portland. We're working with Multnomah County. In fact, this resolution that Metro is doing, it joins what the city and the county already did last fall. We're really excited that all three of our government entities now will be divested.
All right, Sandy Polishuk, 350pdx.org.
Yes.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
You're very welcome.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Rising Up with Sonali Kolhatkar at 6. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Tomorrow's weather, sunny with a high in the low 80s, and east of the Cascades in Hood River, also sunny with a high in the mid-80s. On this date in 1958, President Dwight Eisenhower established the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA. The quote of the day is from astronaut Sally Ride. She said, "If we want scientists and engineers in the future, we should be cultivating the girls as much as the boys."
It's 5:18, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The Bernie for President campaign is over, but the political revolution that he launched against corporate rule is just beginning. Sanders and close advisors are now strategizing and developing a new organizational structure to keep growing the grassroots rebellion. But a multitude of Bernie supporters are not waiting on a smoke signal from headquarters. Their percolate-up creativity has already burst into new political organizing projects that are advancing this energized populist movement. One such effort got underway just 3 days after the final Democratic primary. Some 3,000 Bernie-crats from across America gathered in Chicago for the People's Summit. Rather than being morose or cynical about Sanders not winning the nomination, attendees were exuberant about the movement that he galvanized. This extraordinary event was a combination of tent revival and a big workshop for strategizing, organizing, and mobilizing. This two-day summit was convened by National Nurses United and co-sponsored by more than 50 diverse and effective democracy-building groups. This meeting had a minimum of the usual blah-blah and a maximum of planning on how to put experienced, local-based organizers and volunteers directly into growing the movement, starting now. These ever larger and broader local coalitions will, 1, be rooted in principled anti-corporate policies, 2, launch direct grassroots initiatives and actions on a range of populist issues, 3, recruit, train, and elect thousands of movement candidates to school boards, city councils, state legislatures, and other offices, 4, deepen the relationships and sense of shared purpose in this revolutionary democratic movement, and 5, make it fun, putting the party back in politics. This is Jim Hightower saying, for more information, go to thepeoplesummit.org, thepeoplesummit.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Prosecutions in the death of Freddie Gray while in police custody have come to a halt after the Baltimore State Attorney's Office dropped all remaining charges against officers. State Attorney Marilyn Mosby says that individual members of the Baltimore Police Department obstructed the investigation. She said it was clear the system is inadequate as it relies on police policing themselves. FSRN's Jacob Resnick has more.
Baltimore prosecutors have dropped all outstanding charges against three police officers who are yet to stand trial for the killing of Freddie Gray. The move came on the same day that the fifth trial was set to begin. Gray died April 19, 2015, as a result of a severed spine suffered while in the back of a police van. Baltimore's chief prosecutor, Marilyn J. Mosby, said Wednesday that she decided to drop the charges after three earlier trials ended in acquittals. In all three, officers opted for a bench trial in which the judge, not a jury, decides the outcome of the case. At a Wednesday press conference, a defiant Mosby said that any future trials would probably come before the same judge.
No matter how much we may disagree with his rulings, we do not believe that Freddie Gray killed himself. We stand by the medical examiner's determination that Freddie Gray's death was a homicide.
Mosby has been under a gag order since last October. Now that all charges are dropped, she is free to discuss the details of the investigations and what led to her decision to drop the rest of the charges.
However, after much thought and prayer, it has become clear to me that without being able to work with an independent investigatory agency from the very start, without having a say in the election of whether our cases proceed in front of a judge or a jury, without communal oversight of policing in this community, without real substantive reforms to the current criminal justice system, we could try this case 100 times and cases just like it, and we would still end up with the same result.
Mosby further complained her office was forced to rely on investigators from the Baltimore Police Department. The team included officers who witnessed the events that led to Gray's death, lead detectives who were uncooperative, failing to execute search warrants to collect evidence, and officers who even manufactured evidence once trials were underway.
As you can see, whether investigating, interrogating, testifying, cooperating, or even complying with the state, we've all bore witness to an inherent bias that is a direct result of when police police themselves.
In April 2015, the 25-year-old black man made eye contact with a police officer. On that basis, two officers chased and detained him. Video captured at the scene shows officers placing Gray, who is apparently screaming in pain, into a police van without belting him in. During the trip, police removed him from the van, shackled him, and returned him to the vehicle. He died 1 week later after suffering severe spinal injuries. While no officers have been held accountable for Gray's death, the Baltimore Police Department has updated procedures and policies. Officers are required to call a medic when requested, and cameras must be both worn and installed in transport vans. Gray's father, Freddie Gray Sr., said while he is angry about the outcome of the three trials, his family understands Mosby's decision.
We are very proud of the prosecutors who handled the case and did their best to their ability. We stand behind Maryland and her prosecuting team.
Yes, we do.
And my family's proud to have them represent us.
The U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division launched a still ongoing pattern and practice probe of the Baltimore Police Department last May, and five of the six officers initially charged have filed civil suits against State Attorney Mosby on allegations ranging from violation of constitutional rights, false arrest, and false imprisonment to defamation. Those cases are still pending. Jacob Resnick, FSRN.
The Pentagon says it's investigating what could be its deadliest strike on civilians in Syria since its anti-ISIS campaign began 2 years ago. Syrian opposition groups and monitors said a strike on July 19th likely killed more than 100 people, including entire families near the city of Manbij in Syria's Aleppo province. FSRN's Nell Abram reports.
Speaking from Baghdad, U.S. Army Colonel Christopher Garver said Wednesday that the anti-ISIS coalition reviewed reports of U.S. warplanes killing civilians and has completed a preliminary probe.
That credibility assessment is complete, and the result was that the information available was credible enough to warrant formal investigation, which we have initiated.
The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights reported heavy civilian casualties during several days of airstrikes last week around the village of Tokar, near the city of Manbij. The Pentagon says, so far, it's only probing strikes from a single day. The city of Manbij is currently besieged by Kurdish and Arab opposition fighters trying to dislodge militants loyal to the self-styled Islamic State. Chris Woods is an investigative journalist who leads Air Wars, a group of researchers and reporters based in the Middle East and Europe who focus on civilian casualties from international airstrikes in Iraq and Syria. Wood says the group has cataloged the names of 74 civilians, including children, killed last week, identifying them through five separate sources as local residents. But how many more may have died in the U.S. and allied airstrikes remains unclear.
Where it gets a bit more confusing is how many others may have died in this event. That may have been internally displaced people that have been pushed out or had left Manbij, where the siege is going on at the moment. So unnamed civilians is one suggestion, may have also been included in the dead. And some counts are placing those numbers in the 120s, 130s. It certainly looks to us from the reporting we've seen that this is the single greatest loss of civilian life in any coalition action in 2 years of war, unfortunately.
Woods is encouraged that the Pentagon has quickly acknowledged the reports of the deaths, but says it's often 6 months before a military probe is completed.
Around Manbij right now, we have a big problem. It's not just the Tokar event of last week, but we've actually logged more than 40 alleged civilian casualty events over the last couple of months, just in this small area, reportedly from the very intense coalition campaign to liberate that town from so-called Islamic State. So we think there's a big problem around Manbij, a lot of civilians reportedly being killed, and we think any lessons to be learned from Tokar need to be applied tactically right now. We can't really wait for 6 months for CENTCOM to let us know what went wrong here.
Immediately after the deadly strikes on civilians, the opposition Syrian coalition called for a moratorium on U.S.-led strikes in the region. But in a statement released Wednesday, the U.S.-led anti-ISIS coalition claimed 360 ISIS targets in Syria and Iraq had been destroyed by both manned aircraft and drones between July 19 and 25 alone. For FSRN, I'm Nell Abram.
This has been the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell and Tony Longshanks. The producer is Jenna Yokoyama. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News and Labor Radio. Engineering is Ian, Chairman of the Board, Gadbury. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Jenna Yokoyama. Coming up on Monday on KBOO, at 7 a.m., it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, Celeste Carey welcomes Douglas Tsao of Portland Underground Grad School, Claire Vlach, of Teacher of Tactical Urbanism 101, and Anthony Alvarado, Teacher of DIY Magic. At 9, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, host Barbara Bernstein speaks with Lori Kaplan, one of two women who led the fight to stop liquefied natural gas in Clatsop County. And at 11, it's Madness Radio, hosted by Will Hall. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Good night, Liam.
Good night, Jen.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, media present the debate over police violence in black communities as almost hopelessly fraught, as it's tied up with the country's history of white supremacy and racial division. That can't explain the unwillingness to address another increasingly undeniable reality, the frequency with which law enforcement use of force involves people with disabilities, and the particular